in this episode.
Look, I just want to show I'm just an actor. I turn up, I do acting.
Hey, it's quite nice when people all pour into a room wanting to adore you.
Showbiz.
I know him as the guy who chainsawed off his hand and then said, "Give me sugar, baby."
Well, yes. Of course I want to do that. There's money involved, plus there will be gurning.
He simultaneously celebrated and a cautionary tale not to.
We don't want any of your silly stuff during this performance. This is real acting that you're doing here.
I think once you get A-list status, I think you really have to take a step back for your own mental health.
It was awful. I was living in a tiny wood shack in the middle of the woods in a Tennessee winter. It was just awful.
All right, so it wasn't like he was a breakout character who got a spin-off. It was a contractually necessary TV movie.
A lot of Hollywood actors have to pump out content on their podcast channels in order to continue to stay relevant.
Can you work in some kind of thing about our Facebook page and just work out some sort of gag quickly with that?
No, I'm not a performing monkey.
Here's what I heard. Blah, blah, blah. Science, science, science.
Leo, I have a problem. Don't take this the wrong way, but you made this big speech about, you know, we need to be more beardy, and yes, I agreed with that, and we're going to discuss things in greater depth and really get into the detail and stuff like that, but then you opened up with the Bruce Campbell show as our opener and this new theming thing we're doing. Now, don't get me wrong, I like Bruce Campbell, but in terms of being beardy, isn't he a guy that kind of smashed plates on his face and cut his hands off with a chainsaw and said some quotable lines? Now, he's great with his fans, to his credit, and by all means, under our old regime, I'd be all for making a podcast about this character, but surely now, when we're trying to be more serious, why are we doing
it? It's interesting you say that. You see, there's two layers to the whole Bruce Campbell phenomenon. One, as you say, is the performing sideshow gimp, and I'm sure that he wouldn't mind being referred to as such. But then there's the other side of his personality, which is that he is intensely interested in the relationship between fans and movie stars or actors, whereas most stars are at best indifferent to it, or at least they are very keen, as indeed Mr. Campbell is himself, because it's a sense of practicality, is the survival that you have to be. There has to be like a boundary, a distance, but Bruce Campbell pushes that boundary about as far as it is until it's almost in danger of dissolving. And that is why we're here to look at his career today. Because as we shall discover, it's not a particularly remarkable career. If you just took the career itself as a CV, then there are a lot of actors who have very similar careers. But it's the fact of what he's made of the career he's been given that pushes him maybe into a little bit of an outlier category. That's what I'm attempting to demonstrate through this retrospective and having a look at the Bruce Campbell phenomenon as it is.
Okay, how should we begin this?
Part one is The Life of Bruce Campbell, which is looking at his CV, his career. I mean, in fact, if we actually wanted to examine the life of Bruce Campbell to a certain extent, we have more material than a lot of places, because he's written two volumes of what he's planning to be a trilogy, where he's currently working on the third volume, because he's living his life. You see? That's what's happening. But yeah, he's done two volumes of autobiography, and the first volume does in fact detail his early life. Almost it's a way of a window into looking at why people become actors or performers in particular. The first thing he mentions, of course, in his autobiography is the scar that he has on his chin. A famous scar.
Famous chin.
And people wonder how he got it. Famous chin. Well, the chin is famous partially because it is quite so square, but also because it has the scar on it, which presupposes that he got that in some kind of zombie fight or similar. But this is not the truth. The truth was he doesn't per se actually remember specifically the specific incident, but just he and his brothers used to play harsh practical jokes and fight a lot. So it pre-existed any of his film work, and therefore he has borne it for the whole of his career. That is what it is. And that's the thing. He grew up in an environment where he was with, I believe he has two brothers, and I think he is the youngest of all of the brothers, and they just used to roughhouse constantly and play stupid tricks on each other and other people.
And this really set him up for his breakout role, really, didn't it?
Yes, it did, because this is how he sort of lived his life. He liked hanging around making schemes with his brothers. And then as he grew up, he was lucky in that he got involved with Rob Tappert and Sam Raimi at school and college. And they together made films, many of which were 60% messing about, roughhousing and playing pranks on one another, and 40% actually making a film. You see, the whole thing up to 1981, when The Evil Dead got made, everything up to The Evil Dead, he actually mentions, and is on his CV, the names of some of the shorter, I wouldn't know even what to call them. I would know what to call them. They're what we used to do when we got given cameras and told to go and do stuff. They would be expecting 7 minutes and we'd come back with 40. He wasn't making shorts per se. He was making whatever he could make. This is Sam Raimi, and Bruce Campbell was along for the ride. If I had continued to be into the films, then I would say he would have been our like Tom Jenkins or Matthew Long. That he is the guy who was like, yeah, I want to be involved in this. Don't you kick me out of this. I'm gonna do it. And then that's how he managed to happen to be stood in the right place. Or maybe the wrong place.
Yes.
When The Evil Dead came.
Yes, Tom Jenkins and Matthew Long were two chums of yours from youth theatre. It was youth theatre, yes. So that's how we managed to rope in our quote-unquote actors. Mind you, they were game for it, and they were always fun guys to be around. So basically, he was having a good lark with his college mates and accidentally became a film star.
Well, I don't think there's much accidental about it. You've seen The Evil Dead, obviously.
Of course, because I know you.
Would you have seen it if you didn't know me?
Well, I had seen Army of Darkness, because I was of an age where I could see that in the cinema when it came out. I think my brother went and saw it. So that was the first one, and the only one I saw for Yonks and Yonks and Yonks. And then finally, one of my trips when I was coming back to visit you in the UK, you had another friend pop over whilst I was there, and he had seen the first Evil Dead movie. And so then you're like, oh, then now we've got to make you watch the other two. You've got to see the Bruce. So then I watched 2 and 3 again back to back. There. He was actually less impressed than we hoped he would be by the whole experience. Maybe it's a generational thing, I don't know.
I think there's a certain amount to which these days you could make The Evil Dead on an iPhone as long as you had buckets of fake gore and some makeup effects and some actors who were willing to put up with the privations of making like a zero budget movie funded almost entirely by dentists. It has to be said that, one of the things that kind of slips under the radar and is made obvious by the autobiography is that Bruce Campbell was involved in production as much as he was an actor. Weirdly, I think this is because of Tappert, Raimi and Campbell's love of the Three Stooges. Their business dealings, although obviously they must have taken place in a more sort of business-oriented vibe when they actually happen, he describes as the Three Stooges visiting the bank for a loan. I mean, there's always this idea that there's this bunch of chances with their hands out for a bit of money. And amazingly, the suits occasionally dispense a bit of pocket money out of the vault. And then they run off and make a Three Stooges movie with zombies. But yeah, I mean, the point is that the other actors are actors and who are being paid out of that fund. I think what contributes to Campbell's special status among fans, and what makes him sort of someone who people who might not be fans will encounter and then be underwhelmed by, is the fact that he's not just an actor. He loves the whole shebang, but probably doesn't much like going to people asking for money. But, you know, who does?
I know him as a guy who chainsawed off his hand and then said, "Give me sugar, baby." But perhaps we could start going through the menu of, if you were a fan of Bruce Campbell, these are the things you might be interested in viewing.
This is the thing. What you would go and look at to be a Bruce Campbell fan, comes later on. There is a golden age, which we shall come up to. But in the beginning, we've got, what, Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Maniac Cop, Army of Darkness. These are all pretty much the things that you would expect. And then the usual thing of actors working at this level, of little appearances here and there. I mean, yeah, he's the Ronaldo the heel in Crime Wave. He was supposed to be the main character, but the studio didn't have faith in him to carry a movie, so they hired an actor instead. And from the autobiography, indeed, I've seen Crime Wave. I think it's a perfectly fun movie, but the way that he talks about it, he's particularly, it's like Kevin Smith's Mallrats. It's like The Evil Dead is Clark's, Crime Wave is Mallrats, and Evil Dead 2 is more on the Chasing Amy side. It's actually weird how those three movies pan out exactly the same as a Kevin Smith's, where it's like one thing they made by themselves, the studio gets more involved, they feel uncomfortable with it, they move on to make something that's closer to what they do, but obviously the studio's like, well, you know, how are we going to make Bottle Lightning twice? And in fact, Smith had a bit of a raw deal there because Chasing Amy, although technically a better movie even than Clark's, isn't as well regarded, whereas Evil Dead 2 is like the pinnacle of the Evil Dead phenomenon.
And perhaps it's simply because Evil Dead is a cult film, and Clark's is definitely a cult film, whereas Chasing Amy, wouldn't we describe that as a cult film exactly?
Well, no, that's the problem, you see, because Mallrats had this miasma of being like a wannabe cult movie. And the things often get accused of being wannabe cult movies. In fact, some of Bruce Campbell's movies have been accused of being wannabe cult movies. Like, cult movies have to be discovered, and they have to be, which is, I mean, The Evil Dead got a good boost from being on the video nasty list in the UK. And then in 1987, Evil Dead 2, that was when the nasty panic had faded away. But it was allowed to be a cult movie because, indeed, the people who were involved and that state really done anything else much of note in the meanwhile. The thing about The Evil Dead, and this is, I kind of knew this before, and the autobiography goes into more details about this, but it was kind of like a pauper's version of the shoot of Apocalypse Now or Days of Heaven. Like, these are two movies which were made and backed by big studios pumping large amounts of money into these directors' ego trips. And famously both, well, at least, you know, Francis Ford Coppola came back with a movie that's well regarded. So probably that's closer to the equivalent of The Evil Dead. But both of them were famously shoots that were terrible to be on, that were awful, like most of the actors don't want to talk about it, and so on and so forth. In fact, I think the only reason Bruce Campbell himself is quite well disposed towards The Evil Dead because it gave him a kickstart, and he was deeply embedded in the production. So when it got made, it was his triumph. And I think this is the key line between the professional actor and someone who does dabble further in production, is that when it's made, you're like, I made this. I helped to make this thing a thing. Whereas when you're an actor, it's like, I turned up, I said some funny voices and pulled some funny faces, and then I left. And that was my job.
To what level was Bruce Campbell involved in the production of these films?
Well, I mean, Evil Dead, for example, after it was mostly finished, and he stayed on with the second unit to get a bunch of rubbish shots done as winter was coming in Tennessee. And there was there's this whole bit in the book about the guy who used to bring their groceries to the shack during the shoot started leaving them at the end of the drive. And it's not a drive like a normal drive. We're talking like quarter of a mile's walk. So we had to walk through the freezing snow out of this shack, which had like snow blowing in through the cracks, because they had no choice. All the equipment was there. Somebody had to guard it. They were living there on cot beds in this shack from The Evil Dead. He said, you know, it was awful. I was living in a tiny wood shack in the middle of the woods in a Tennessee winter. It was just awful. And in fact, in between, because, I mean, the CV here on the screen is like 1981, and then the next major role of any sort is Crime Wave, 1985. 4 years of Bruce Campbell's life go by, and he did, like, repertory theatre and stuff like that. This is one of the reasons why I shied away from getting involved in these industries, because there's long periods where you don't know if you've ever work again. You don't know if you're wasting your time, and you're just trying to get a finger through a crack to make a bigger hole for yourself to occupy your niche. And it was just like, I don't think I had the temperament for it. I think Bruce Campbell's probably far more on the down to earth on this. He gets reasonable paychecks, bearing in mind the fact that there are vast periods of uncertainty about whether his career is done or whether he's going to do something else or what have you. And where he's kind of pushing forward is the fact that he is keen to do another project, whereas some actors are quite happy to go, oh, I'll wait till the phone rings.
He is most well known, at least I think in genre circles, for being an Evil Dead guy. So why Evil Dead 2? And why essentially remake the first film and then expand upon it with greater lunacy? I mean, why even revisit it in such a direct revisitation way?
Well, from Bruce Campbell's point of view, he was hired for a job. It was Sam Raimi that wanted to do Evil Dead 2, and by wanted, he wanted to make something that would make money so he'd be able to keep going. I mean, Evil Dead 2 is the product of Robert Tappert being the producer of all of these things, and Sam Raimi and so on and so forth. They all wanted their career, and then Crime Wave had gone so poorly for Raimi, even though, I mean, that's where they met the Coens. I mean, people kind of forget this, but Sam Raimi, Robert Tappert, the Coens, and to a lesser extent Bruce Campbell. But those people are like, they're like alumni. They're like people who knew each other in that sort of early to mid 80s period. And then the Coen brothers have gone on and done what they did. And Sam Raimi's gone off and done what he did. But they all have this kind of, I think, a mutual love all across the board of like this sort of Three Stooges, vaudeville sensibility, which comes through in all the various ways in which they do stuff. I mean, this is why I think the Coens and Raimi got on so well, is because of this love of showbiz in a very huckstery P.T. Barnum kind of way. And I think that's an important component in Campbell's career and in the careers of all of the other people that we're talking about here. But whereas the Coens, well, the Coens are still the Coens. They always were the Coens. They're a riddle wrapped in an enigma. You know what you know about the Coens. Raimi seems to have started out with his hand out, really, saying, look, give me stuff, I'm going to make stuff. And is now more of a traditional Hollywood director. And that's what's really interesting, because I think Bruce Campbell definitely sees himself as an actor, but he also has taken on other roles of helpfulness, such as being a bridge between fans at conventions and the sort of the world of stardom, and being someone who, when he couldn't get a film to act in, would go, well, hell, I'll just make a film myself. And that's his whole persona, really, a construction that's in front of this guy who is incredibly driven to do more stuff, but he's got a very specific area of interest within that. Maniac Cop in that stage is one of the key texts. Like, he describes it in the book, but he like runs past it with his arm out, because he was essentially at that gig. He was the actor who turned up to do the job, and then that was it. He went home. He wasn't involved. And I think that's one of the things. I think one of the things that may even have held him back from being more a bigger sort of actor type actor is that he wanted to be involved right from the get-go. He always wanted to stick his finger in, see how it worked, see how everything was going on. And earlier on, when he was making exploitation movies, the director just needed him to turn up, stand where he was supposed to stand, say the lines without getting too many of them wrong or being too drunk, and then go. That's what they needed. And so his further interest was probably not really appreciated in most cases. 1981, nobody knows who he is. Then he has a few bits and bobs that he does. And then 1992, he's back as Ash, Army of Darkness. Even though Evil Dead 2 is like the gold mark of Evil Dead movies, Army of Darkness is probably the biggest movie. It's lighter than the Evil Dead movies due to the fact that it's an extended skeleton battle as opposed to just like buckets of blood being strewn everywhere. And at that point, he kind of launches into, he's got an associate role in Hudsucker Proxy, has got a small role in Congo. He's got no real role at all, but I thought I'd mention that he was standing around somewhere in The Quick and the Dead. Almost exclusively you know, there was this whole thing, oh, Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi, they're such good friends. And they are. But does that mean that Sam Raimi automatically casts him in movies? No, it doesn't. What it means is that Sam Raimi goes to the set to say hi to his buddy Sam, and Sam goes, Campbell, don't just stand there, go and stand in front of that camera and do this. So often when he appears in Sam Raimi movies, it's because he turned up for lunch and Sam Raimi made him be in the movie.
He's on the notes for, you know, he was in a deleted scene for Quick and the Dead. I'm thinking, God, man, he would have been fine as one of the also-ran gunslingers in that film.
Oh, yeah.
Why didn't they put him in one of those roles? He would have been awesome.
I mean, obviously, same thing applies with the Coens and Fargo. Escape from L.A. was very much a maniac cop job. Right, okay, so John Carpenter makes another Snake Plissken movie and Bruce Campbell's involved. Ah, that must have been a thing. But the autobiography, again, gives the lie to that. They're just, no, he turned up, he did his part. Like, even Sam Raimi, he tells Bruce off. Like, directors are like, we don't want any of your silly stuff during this performance. This is real acting that you're doing here. Not all of your gurning and smashing plates on your face and, you know, all of that stuff. We want real acting. And it does come through in his autobiography that he is like, not, it's not a shame, it's like that's a shtick that he does and he's very good at it, but he wishes people wouldn't measure him by that. Which is why it becomes more interesting the further you go through his career, the kinds of things that he chooses to get involved with. The thing is, it is unfortunate as well because he clearly evidently does love that. In the whole time that he's appearing in a lot of movies, he's also got a chance to star in his first television series, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr., which ran for one season. He was three episodes of Lois and Clark, and that was huge. His part in American Gothic, Meet the Beatles, that was one of, and The Homicide, 95-96. That's the ones where he was going, look, I just want to show I'm just an actor. I turn up, I do acting. And The Homicide in particular, he was very keen to be not comedy Bruce whatsoever. The only problem is that when Robert Tapert and Sam Raimi turn up and go, hey, how would you like to be in 10 episodes of Hercules Legendary Journeys playing the King of Thieves? He's like, well, yes, of course I want to do that. There's money involved, plus there will be gurning. And I think that's the problem. As soon as somebody's ready to offer him a gurning role, and it's all, you know, serious acting work, he's like, well, I'm doing the gurning, which I love. And it's a union job, so I get money and I get reputation. Of course he's going to do it. But then, of course, people are looking at his CV from an industry perspective and go, oh, yeah, Bruce Campbell, he's the one that does the gurning, right? Which is a problem because on the one hand, you want to be paid more and recognized for your work on American Gothic and Homicide, but there's less of that work and more of the gurning. And so what are you going to do, eh? What are you going to do? When it comes to Hercules Xena, he directed episodes, he did all the stuff. What I think he discovered, and if he'd have been able to see the future, I think he might have gone even further down this path. When it came to television, he found out that people were a lot more flexible about letting him get his finger in the pie. But I think he wanted to be a film actor, and it was like this whole conflict, which I think actors have. And now it's even worse, because we're in the golden age of television. So actors really have a big problem deciding whether they want to do a lot of television or do films, which essentially is like kind of sitting around in a dentist's waiting room and then standing in front of a camera and doing something 50 times and then going home and eventually get stitched together into a movie. But the movie might be huge, whereas television is still television, even though it gets a lot of recognition. So, you know, you can see that going up.
I think there's more need, I think, from your internet provider channel, which just dumps an entire series on you to watch in one burst. I think that sort of format of television is kind of where you go to act these days, and they have attracted some proper stars to come down to do 10 episodes of something.
There are actors who, seriously, I think, would feel better off in the media of television because of the way that the media themselves have shaped up.
Definitely in the past, there was a very strong, you were film actor and there were television actors, and television actors were of a different league to film. And even though film will always have the bigger audience, always, I think that sort of separation is not...
No, it isn't at all, because I think the industry itself has got wind of the fact that you go to different media to do different types of work, which wasn't the case. If you remember, once upon a time, we remarked upon the Matt Damon, Danny DeVito movie, The Rainmaker, from the 90s. You watch it today and you're like, why is this a movie? Why isn't it like an HBO 10-part miniseries?
Because there are no medium-budget films anymore, so we find it anachronistic.
And they don't put the kind of content that you would find traditionally on an HBO or high-end crime drama procedural type thing. They put that on television now. There's no point putting it in the cinema. Who wants to go to cinema? Television picture quality has got so good that you literally don't miss anything. So there's no point. And that's what's happened to the media. And I think that, Bruce Campbell definitely got the way the wind was blowing. Because, he got his second crack at television, being the star of a television show in 2000 with a show called Jack of All Trades, which was actually, it wasn't a spin-off of Xena, but it was like what the Xena crew did after. And for some reason, I can't even follow it. I think that the big disadvantage that was on the people who were creating in that stage, in this case, Bruce Campbell, who's got, as it says, also co-executive producer, is that he's from like near Michigan way. And this was all happening in Australia and New Zealand. And so I think he was necessarily removed from where all the decisions were made. And while he wasn't there, they decided that what they really needed to follow up Hercules and Xena, which had been pretty popular to the point where Xena had outstripped Hercules in popularity, was to go from the hour action show format to a half hour action show format. And I can count the number of half hour action shows that worked out on the fingers of one hand. And that what they would do is have one show that was just basically like a sort of a low budget Futurama-esque but smutty Futurama-esque called Cleopatra 2525. And the other half of that hour would be this Jack of All Trades show, which was like, is it a sitcom? Is it an action show? We don't even know. And that lasted predictably for one season before everyone went, I don't even know what you're trying to do there, man. What was that about?
But I do note he directed 2 episodes of Xena Warrior Princess.
Yeah.
Clearly he was still on the production side.
Oh yeah, no, the production company that did all of that stuff, it was Raimi and Tapper. They were producing those shows. They were the showrunners. They were the equivalent of Joss Whedon on Buffy or, you know, Russell T. Davis on Doctor Who or whatever. So that, he was part of that inner circle of people who were making Hercules and Xena while he was also trying to run a career.
But I would maintain, definitely in the 90s, there was not as much as it was in the past, but in the 90s there still was a separation of television and film, I think back then. So it was, in terms of career trajectory, I suppose you could say, a step down. Obviously, if you're getting work, that's no bad thing if you're an actor. And if you're migrating to behind the camera, that's no bad thing either.
There's a definite sense that he didn't want to just be trailing around after Sam Raimi's whole life, and he probably took that decision pretty early on. And that's probably a good call, because otherwise he'd have become a bit of like Sam Raimi's version of Johnny Depp to Tim Burton. It's like, it's got to the point now where it's like, it's a Tim Burton movie and it has Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter in it. And you're like, okay, we're doing this again, are we? Yeah. At least you're not bored. But what he did in the early 2000s was he took a very wise decision. To be fair, I've listened to the man read the autobiographies on the audiobook, and he's not averse, especially in the first one, to just like taking a little sidebar and going, oh, by the way, about this, what happened after was this. So he's like literally like just going through and he's reminiscing and he's telling the stories and the anecdotes, and it's in a very real sense he's reliving it. So I never got the sense that he consciously did. But it was a very wise choice that between Jack of All Trades and jumped straight in feet first into the renaissance of television as a medium, he did a series of projects in amongst getting paid to be in the Spider-Man trilogy as the first person to be Mysterio but never revealed. It was retconned. His character's name is Quentin Beck. In all of that's why he appears as different people.
He would have been a good Mysterio as well. That's a shame.
Yes, I think he had the perfect thing, but then obviously the whole Spider-Man 3 thing took place and that was it. in that time between 2000 and 2007, there was Bubba Hotep, there was Alien Apocalypse, Man with the Screaming Brain, both of which sci-fi original movies that they got money to go and make in Eastern Europe. He was conscious of just keeping himself in the area, like, so that people could see who he was. And then, of course, that all comes to a head with My Name is Bruce, which I did rewatch as research, because I thought, if I'm going to watch one Bruce Campbell thing to refresh myself, I think the one that you watch is My Name is Bruce, which is like the super meta Bruce Campbell project. Besides which, in the autobiography, he described how the main location of this movie, which is this tiny little town called Goldlick, they couldn't find anywhere to put the set. So they built it in his backyard, essentially, on his property of several acres. And so when you see him for the majority of that movie, you are seeing him making a movie literally in his backyard. You know, 1981 to 2007, how much has changed? Well, now I have a backyard big enough to make my own monster movies in. So all the time, there's also his documentary, Phanalysis. There's also his little appearances in things like Sky High. You put that all together, and what he's doing, consciously or unconsciously, is embedding himself and glorying in his status as cult actor, because at that stage, the sort of movie TV thing is going on outside, but he's not sure that he's going to have that kind of solid moment in his career. I mean, this is the thing. A lot of people with Bruce Campbell's career would have given up at some point, because there was never that moment of certainty. There was never that little moment of stability for nearly 30 years. And then he landed the role of Sam Axe in Burn Notice.
Just before we get to Burn Notice, which is probably his most successful project outside of Evil Dead, and just look over the trajectory of his career at this point, he's kind of Mr. Cameo, isn't he? He was famous for gurning and smashing plates in his face and cutting his hand off and saying, "Give me sugar, baby." And so he has this reputation of being a larger-than-life kind of distinctive cameo guy. And he's plugged into various parts, hoping that, you know, we'll put this guy in there and he'll just nail it and make that small part memorable. But there's no kind of, he's not really a leading man again, is he, until we get to really Burn Notice.
And he's not the leading man now. I mean, this is the thing. In all the movies that he's famous for, he is the leading man. Dr. Ivan Hood and William Cole in Man with the Screaming Brain and so on and so forth. And the leading man in Bubba Hotep, where he plays Elvis. That in My Name is Bruce, there's this whole joke about him being the leading man. Quickly fast forward to Ash and the Evil Dead. In the first episode of Ash and the Evil Dead, it is made plain that Ash lives in a trailer, which is interesting because in My Name is Bruce, the version of Bruce Campbell that is the star of My Name is Bruce also lives in an almost identical trailer to Ash from Ash and the Evil Dead, thus exposing the innards of the joke, being this is a film about the kind of the Bruce Campbell persona as it appears in these projects. And essentially My Name is Bruce is, well, it came up because he had some money kicking about and he'd done Bubba Hotep, line in My Name is Bruce. Oh, I like Bubba Hotep. Everybody liked Bubba Hotep. That's the sort of high career watermark of his movie career. Is him playing Elvis in Bubba Hotep. It's a very well-regarded, proper cult movie, which has enough weirdness aside from the shtick in it to make it properly fascinating. What attracted him to Burn Notice, seeing all the rest of it, is that there aren't that many shows that are made in Miami. There's obviously Miami Vice. But Miami isn't really, it's not New York. It's not on the West Coast, so it's not like the sort of Los Angeles thing. I mean, he's probably kicking himself. They make several television shows now in Portland, you know, Grimm and stuff like that. Portland and that whole Pacific Northwest area has become quite the place for making television series for some sort. But he's not in any of those. No, he's a guy who lives very adjacent to that whole thing that's going off, going down south for like 6 months of the year to make a show about a burnt spy, which is like the only thing that is really going on in the film and television industry in Miami. And I think that was the kind of thing, is that, again, he's found this community of people who are doing a thing, and they're kind of outsiders within the society that they're living in. I think he really enjoyed being in a show that lasted more than one season.
Seven seasons.
Yeah, it is a massive show.
You were saying about no one makes a TV show in Miami, but this is exactly the same period when Dexter was being made. So Miami, for this glorious period, had two TV shows about it, and they both ended in 2013.
Oh, right, okay, fair enough. I don't know anything about Dexter. It never really appealed. Burn Notice is very interesting. It is like the closest thing that modern television has to, like, the A-Team, basically. There's another show I'm watching at the moment called Scorpion, possibly the worst named television show I've ever had, because Scorpion sounds like it's going to be some kind of DEA, kind of gritty kind of thing, whereas it's actually this cute show about super geniuses who solve crime like the A-Team. And that's exactly the thing. It's like, yes, it's kind of a teamwork, A-team character-based show, but it has this wrinkle that all of the people in it are geniuses, as opposed to having, like, a good pilot and a good driver and a guy who finesses people and a planner, which is just kind of like, that's your A-team kind of level. In exactly the same way, Burn Notice has the planner and then the psychopathic girlfriend who likes guns, or ex-girlfriend, as it described there, and then a sort of former Marine, probably a bit past his best, but knows all the military tactics and stuff. It has that sort of alchemy of, these are mostly normal people, but they all have their special skills and they bring them to the party. Whereas Scorpion is just like a stupid show about super geniuses jumping from moving vehicles onto other moving vehicles, or doing crazy superhuman feats, and also being the smartest guys in the room.
Yes. Yeah, you're saying about Scorpion, because you're saying the name Scorpion, it does make you think it's going to be a show about the drug cartel, doesn't it? And yet it's not. It is the most misnamed show on television.
It's a cute show about Uber MacGyver show. Burn Notice is very much in that sort of tradition of 80s television. And I think that's one of the reasons why it sort of went down so well, because a lot of people... I think there's a large amount of people that want to watch The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire and New Battlestar Galactica, there's also some people can't we have a show where you watch a show and then it doesn't really matter whether you watch the next show or not? You'll pick it up. It'll happen. And they always do the same thing.
So talk to me about Bruce Campbell in Burn Notice and his character.
Sam Hanks is actually pretty decent as a character for Bruce Campbell, because it gives him an opportunity to go while not requiring that he does so. And so he is in full control of whether he hams it up and becomes Hamax, or whether he tries to put in something a little bit more solidly in the acting genre. And the thing about it is that it has humour in it. It's a kind of show that is drama action and has funny moments, but it's not a comedy. Jeffrey Donovan, who is very deeply involved in the production, big surprise there. I think he was conscious that the way he wanted the chemistry of the show to work out was that he was like the straight guy and the other people would be like the comic turn or whatever, or that they had that kind of comedic dynamic between them where at all times one of them would be the straight man and the other one would be the funny guy, and it would work like double acts. That's, I think, one of the reasons why Bruce presented himself as an attractive person to have on the project. There is, of course, The Fall of Sam Axe, the television movie, which I've not seen because it's not included in the streaming services, which is kind of interesting. The reason that came up, and it's openly discussed in the autobiography, is that what you'll find is, I think we all find this, and maybe now we will know the concrete reason why, when it comes to season three of a show, that's where they start to kind of mess around with the format a bit or do something out of the ordinary. Well, the reason for that is because after a show's made it through two seasons, that's the time that they're like, oh yeah, we're going to renegotiate contracts now. And so what happened was that they did the whole negotiation with Bruce and was like, yeah, and he basically took a small pay rise and then found out that, like, Jeffrey Donovan had got loads of money and that they'd kind of treated him like he was an idiot. Because the negotiation had already happened, it was like, well, we don't really just want to just redo the negotiation. And so eventually what they settled on was that the difference in pay would be made up by funding a television movie about Sam Axe, which was helped by the fact that Jeffrey Donovan wanted to direct something, and that seemed like a good project for him to direct.
All right, so it wasn't like he was a breakout character who got a spin-off. It was a contractually necessary TV movie.
Yes, exactly. And you'll notice that it was 2 years adrift of the time that the agreement was made to make that movie. So I think the television network were hoping that they would get forgotten, but it didn't get forgotten. Eventually it got made, and there it is. And then you sort of have him kind of get to the end of that project. He goes to visit Sam Raimi for lunch on Oz the Great and Powerful, ends up being cast as a Winky Guard. At this point, he's definitely taken enough money from Burn Notice that it could, you know, he could afford to slow things down. But instead what he does is he gets straight back on the horse, gets straight back into the Evil Dead horse, and has just obviously in last year concluded 3 seasons of Ash versus the Evil Dead as the older version of Ash. And if the pattern is anything to go by, he's now in a sort of, I've made 3 seasons of a successful television show and been the lead actor in that, albeit in the guise of playing the character that I'm always playing in these things. So at some point, probably next year, year after, we'll find out something else that he's doing that's a bit more of a bigger project. Because he seems to be like, you know, oh, I'm not really working that hard at the moment. Now I'm going hell for leather doing some project. Interestingly, with Ash versus the Evil Dead, the reason that it ended up in this scenario, I mean, again, this is gives the lie to me. When I said I could count the number of half-hour format action shows that had been successful on one hand, one of the fingers on that hand would be used to cast this. It's been an enormously popular show. Half-hour episodes, just essentially each season is 10 episodes. So a 5-hour Evil Dead continuation.
Is it episodic? I haven't seen it. Is it episodic or is it?
Yeah, it's a serial. Yeah, so season one makes like one arc and then the other 2 seasons. This is one of the things that I think is probably a byproduct of his status, is that as a sort of cult actor, what we mean by cult actor is cult American actor. And so I've never seen an episode of Briscoe County Jr. and I've never seen an episode of the other one he did, the Jack of All Trades. The reason being that you can't get hold of them outside of the US. No, yeah, we're never shown, I don't think, even outside of the US. Nobody has any interest in them, and the people who made the DVDs have never bothered to release them outside of the US. Now, Ash vs. the Evil Dead did get wider play because it's the age of streaming, but specifically the network made them stars. Now, the reason why Ash vs. the Evil Dead was actually on the slate at a number of different studios, but stars were the only ones where they went, look, we're going to make an Evil Dead series. You've seen the Evil Dead movies, right? It has to be exactly that pitch and level. And most of the studios were like, but this is TV. And I went, well, see you later. And stars went, do whatever you want. They went, really? Seriously? You have seen the Evil Dead 2, right? I mean, you've seen that. It's going to be exactly like that. But for the modern, yeah, you just go ahead. And I went, all right, then, cool. But the problem that has occurred then is that the streaming part of it got slightly eccentric and the rights have been all over the place and you can get Region 2 DVDs of it, but Season 3 is still a bit and you can't get a complete season box set and all the nonsense that you associate with certain projects that mean that they're not more widely seen. So I've seen the first season. I'm still waiting for my opportunity to see much of the rest, but I am assured that it's just good stuff. I mean, I don't know to what level being successful internationally plays into things getting picked up and running, but I don't think it hurts. Even though the cast of Supernatural, the main cast, certainly don't seem to leave the US that much, because they're too busy shooting 22 to 24 episodes of Supernatural every year for the last 15 goddamn years. Even though they don't, the show is massively popular internationally and has run for 15 seasons. So, and is only ending because they're like, no, seriously, 15 is definitely enough. We've eaten all that we can eat at this buffet and now leaving the table. Please bring us the bill and maybe a wafer thin mint. And similarly, Ash vs. Evil Dead, I think they could have pushed it further and they've kind of elected to let it lie. but maybe it would have gone further if it had been more internationally available. Mm. That's the career so far. He's not showing any signs of giving up or what have you. And as a career, like given the things that he's been in and the things that he's done, it isn't actually all that different to someone like, let's say, Jeffrey Combs or someone like that, except that, and Jeffrey Combs I picked deliberately because Jeffrey Combs' biggest movie appearance is a Reanimator from the early 80s and also the other associated Stuart Gordon type things. Like, he basically had a very similar kickoff in his career to Bruce Campbell. But Jeffrey Combs, one, hasn't done as much quite. I mean, nearly, but he's done a lot more of the, he'll suddenly pop up in a television show that you're watching as a guest star. And of course, he's, does the star turn, in his sort of supporting role in The Frighteners as the crazy FBI agent with all the scars and stuff. But Jeffrey Combs gives you the typical trajectory of that 80s horror cult actor. And Bruce Campbell definitely steps beyond that. Sometimes, given some of the reviews that I looked at for My Name is Bruce, people wish that he hadn't, but he does. I think that the key point here, and what we want to sort of talk about and pick apart next, is that sort of the fact that he's striven to make that whole world. He's like the masked magician of second string jobbing cult actors. He's the masked magician who shows you the wiring under the board and lets you know exactly what a stupid career choice it is, as well as he can. That's kind of the reason why he's worthy of Beardy contemplation, is the fact that he attempts to draw the veil back on the mysterious world of being a movie star or film star actor.
He's simultaneously celebrated and a cautionary tale not to.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think that I went to acting school to learn that if what you want out of your life is not to be an actor, you shouldn't think of it as a possible career path, the way that you might consider being an accountant. Like, people who want to do a lot of things for their life might make money by being an accountant, but there's nobody, I don't think, in these creative fields who enters the field because it's something they do as well as whatever else it is that they do, like raise a family or whatever it is, because all of that inevitably comes second to it. I mean, I'm thinking in the A-list world, the closest thing to Bruce Campbell seems to be Keanu Reeves. But Keanu Reeves doesn't make himself as available because soon as you hit the A-list, you can't. It's impossible. People have to run into you in bus stations or, like, by accident because you can't. Like, Bruce Campbell can announce, I'm going to be at such and such a convention. Come along and say hi if you can. And a few fans turn up and he has a chin wagon. Off he goes. But if Keanu Reeves were to do exactly the same thing and people knew where he was going to be, it would cause chaos.
I think once you get A-list status, I think you really have to take a step back for your own mental health. Apart from anything else, because you have like a godlike status. In a funny sort of way, the omnipresence of being famous is really crushing and does things to your brain. To go back to my subject I always retreat to, you can guess what it is. It's the thing with a flashing lamp on top. It's called the TARDIS.
Right. Doctor Who.
Yes, Doctor Who. A lot of those actors in there didn't necessarily go on to have enormously stellar careers after left Doctor Who. And goodness me, Doctor Who in the 80s and 70s didn't pay you any money to start with. But actors from this sort of genre entertainment of the 80s that kind of have, you know, they still go to the cult conventions all these years later. And they still have this relationship with fans all these years later. Part of that is because, you know, as actors, they obviously they crave feedback and they obviously you crave praise and you have people who watch you just because it's you. And so you seek out these specialist audiences. I mean, they describe working on Doctor Who as like it didn't pay very well, but it was like putting a slab of butter on a hot plate. It just kept dribbling more fat off every so often for years and years and years. And so I feel like Bruce Campbell is kind of like, well, he didn't have this super mega seller successful career particularly, but he's known to fandom. And so he can plug into fandom and he can cultivate that audience of people and he can write books for them to buy and he can make appearances which he can pay, which he gets paid for, and he can do autographs which he makes money for as well. I mean, these convention appearances can be serious money earners for people in the industry, but doesn't necessarily pay you very well because you're not of that particular tier of acting. And so I kind of see him as kind of a, yes, he's cultivated a good relationship with his fans. I say that's, it's many ways, it's good business sense considering where his position is in the industry. You know, he's like, I've only got a very small cult following. Well, I need to really cultivate these fans and really keep them happy because they will turn up and they will pony up money, which I can pay some gas bills. And hey, it's quite nice when people all pour into a room wanting to adore you.
Yeah, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head for the most part. I think that it does only make sense that when you're the guy who went groovy and waved a chainsaw about, I mean, you know, my name is Bruce is that admission. It's interesting that My Name is Bruce is the very last major movie project that he worked on before stepping into Burn Notice. And Burn Notice, while not being the antithesis of everything else he's done, it's certainly far more conventional an amount of work. I think that he could be in danger of underestimating his own heart in the success of that series, because there's a little kick you get out of watching Chainsaw Evil Dead guy just doing a straight acting role in an action series. Scorpion has Eddie K. Thomas, also known as Finch from American Pie, playing one of the geniuses. And I think that in that case, this actor, Eddie K. Thomas, is doing a very good job of plastering over, because, like, you know, you're Finch, right? Like, everywhere he's been. And that this has led to the fact that his other notable film appearance was as the pair of other guys from the Harold and Kumar movies, which is like, really? That's it? I'm known as Finch and that guy. And then I do other acting work by the by, but it never really sticks. Scorpion is his opportunity to make a mark, and he's doing a really good job of it. Bruce Campbell, on the other hand, is like, he's Sam Axe, and he does a very good job. You know, he's Ash, and he's also Sam Axe, but he's never not going to be Ash. In the Doctor Who conversation, I read an article headline the other day that David Tennant was bored of discussing Doctor Who. And if anyone's earned the right to be bored of discussing being Doctor Who out of ex-Doctor Who's, I'd say that he was, like, he's the purple man from Jessica Jones, and he's just done Good Omens. And honestly, Good Omens, Crowley is perfect. Pitch perfect. This is like a man who has now done three roles, which should mean that he can't really be tied to any one of them, because they're all kind of cultish, they're all in the same arena, they're all, I mean, Crowley is a massive part of the Good Omens thing, and he does it so well. But, you know what, I bet he turns up to do Crowley publicity, and someone somewhere still goes, yeah, you know when you were the 10th Doctor? He's like, no, come on!
I can understand his frustration, because he has had such a good career after Doctor Who. Not on film, but on television, he's continued to be very successful wherever he goes.
He did Broadchurch as well, didn't he, which I didn't watch because it was a bit dour for me. But yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, that his father-in-law is the other Doctor who is known for something other than being the Doctor, primarily, because he was in All Creatures Great and Small. These are the people who know that the shadow of the Doctor is long indeed. In these people that we're discussing, Bruce Campbell distinguished himself from it because he went out of Burn Notice and instantly decided to use the credit he'd built up by being in this massive television blockbuster to make an Ash and the Evil Dead series. In a way, he's embracing both sides because he kind of needs both sides to work for he needs both sides for My Name It's Bruce to continue to in any way be funny. So I guess the last thing to wrap up is, Bruce Campbell is undeniably, so far in the history of Hollywood filmmaking, not that he would actually identify as such, because a lot of his filmmaking hasn't been Hollywood-esque, but he is known as a film star. And he's unique in that. In the world of cinema, he's the most accessible. He goes to the conventions. He's the best known person who goes to conventions. Doug Bradley goes to conventions, but he is Pinhead, and that's what he did. And Robert Englund goes to conventions, and he's very aware that whatever else he did, he's mostly Freddy and stuff like that. And also these guys, you know, Pinhead, Freddy, whatever it is, Leatherface, the actors who played them, they're playing the bad guy. Ash is the only kind of heroic person who's the feature. And so there's a lot of things about him that make him not quite the same. He's the odd one out, and he's really taken that to heart. And he can go to conventions and interact with fans. And he is on the sort of a, he's a sort of at the crowning part of that. So the question is, in the future, where television, cinema, YouTube, all of this stuff is all coming together, like, do you know how many of these similar B-list actors have podcasts? Because I'll tell you, it's a lot. A lot of Hollywood actors on that second tier have to pump out content on their podcast channels in order to continue to stay relevant, because apparently you can't just go and do more work to stay relevant these days. You have to do all that stuff. So is Bruce one of a kind? Because he came first, and when he goes, there'll be lots of people doing lots of stuff, but not the way that he did it. I mean, I'm thinking Felicia Day and Will Wheaton, both of these are celebrities whose celebrity kind of rests upon the fact that they interact with fans a lot and are just like fans, in this case, particularly geeky fans.
When Will Wheaton gets a part in something, normally a cameo again, he's kind of being Will Wheaton. Obviously, he was Crusher in Star Trek.
Wesley Crusher.
Wesley Crusher in Star Trek. And obviously that was his biggest credit to date, I'd say. But he's more famous for just being Will Wheaton, man in his 40s now, isn't he? But is Bruce Campbell famous for being Bruce Campbell, or is he still most famous for being the guy who smashed plates in his face, chainsawed off his hands and said, give me sugar, baby?
Yes, that's exactly the point. The answer is both. Because of the Three Stooges' love, by accident, the character of Ash Williams, not so much in the original Evil Dead, I don't think they knew what they were doing there, but certainly by Evil Dead 2, is simultaneously clearly a bit, but also the character in the movie. I mean, this is one of the things, a lot of his fan mail from people who really like his movies, it's just like you're some chump who's wandered into the film set and is now doing this thing, even though he's not even supposed to be there. And he definitely plays upon that. But I think, again, you've kind of identified the key thing, which is that a star these days, I think, or a celebrity can be accessible, but they'll never be as famous, even as Bruce Campbell, because the minute you get past a line in the world of being famous, you can no longer be accessible. I mean, I'm not sure that Jeffrey Combs, for example, has a podcast. I don't think that he needs to have one.
No.
He still could get work in any given sci-fi series if he wants to be a guest star. They'd be like, Jeffrey Combs wants to be on. Yeah, like that. So that's fine. I think that's why Bruce Campbell is unique. And I do think that the future is not, I mean, you know, I can't say for certain, but I don't think we're going to see ever another celebrity exactly like Bruce Campbell, because I think that what happened with his career is a particular thing to the times that he was and the things that he did and the way that things shook out, which is the same for all of us. All of our lives are like that. But in his case, it's led to this kind of weird, is he an actor? Is he a persona? I mean, even when he hosts things as himself, he's not really being himself. He's really taken the trouble to dissect that idea of a guy who does a bit, and how much, when he appears, it's like, how much is it him and how much is it the bit? Ironically, in Burn Notice, where he's pretty much playing Sam Axe straight down the line, just as a jobbing actor, you almost get the feeling that's more Bruce. More Bruce, because Bruce is now pretending to be some guy doing some other stuff. Whereas when he does his more over the top acting, that's like the other Bruce, the My Name is Bruce Bruce, the Bruce persona is doing that stuff, the guy who does the bit. So weirdly, the actor is more the actor when they're not doing a bit, but doing just acting, than they are when they are doing it. It's real head puzzle, hence that's where we are. I think where we're going to finish up on this episode is originally I had this plan, and I'm not 100% either way on which way this is going to go, that we would like to maybe try and put a little something together. Because it's quite easy to reach Bruce Campbell. You could just email him, and I'm pretty sure he'd eventually get the mail. They just get to like a little anthology together of Bruce Campbell type stuff. And you kind of, and then send it to him, obviously. You kind of expressed doubt that we had the pull to make these people do this thing. And my pushback to that was that, you know, fans like to be fans, and this idea of a bunch of fans getting together. Bruce Campbell is a bit like shooting fish in a barrel. Like, I could just send him a mail and he might send me back a note. But if a bunch of people do something and send it to a celebrity as an act of, like, we have made you this thing, then surely that means a little more. It's not just a random letter or a reply to a tweet. And so I thought that that was of, you know, the idea itself should appeal. But then I read some of the things that Bruce Campbell responds to and the kinds of comments that Bruce Campbell gets on his own tweets and Facebook pages and stuff. And I realized that it's incredibly possible that Bruce Campbell fans are, in fact, generally speaking, pretty lazy, because he's an easy guy to be a fan of because he's so available. You don't have to work to be a fan of Bruce Campbell. He's pretty much there all the time. The only thing that he does do is, like, when they say, can you say groovy for me? He says, no, I'm not a performing monkey, which is fine. Barrier set, conversation over. So I'm still keen to know, and I'm still going to try and explore this possibility. But I'm interested to know. I might even try it again with someone who's less accessible in the future, because I've started to come to the opinion that we're not going to get much reply on this, because telling Bruce Campbell you like him is not a difficult thing to do. So why would you write a short story or compose a poem or draw a picture or do any of those things in order to show how much of a fan you were, when you can just go to his Twitter and go, hey, Bruce, you make great movies. You do that funny thing where you bat yourself in the face of plates. Ha ha, I laughed so much. I nearly peed. And he goes, oh, yeah, thanks for that. Great. So, you know, we'll see how that pans out. But in the meantime, we also love attention. Now, I realize we're recording here, and we haven't come up with a bit, have we? We've got the old bit, obviously, but I think that's a bit
hard. Can you work in some kind of thing about, you know, the Necronomicon and our Facebook page, and just work out some sort of gag quickly with that?
Yeah, Klaatu Varada, www.facebook.com/... Revenge of the 80s Kids are the words that you must say. No. So obviously we are available on Facebook, Revenge of the 80s Kids. We are in a sort of fleeting attempt to make more of a community. It has to be said that I don't know whether our content is too, I don't know, thoughtful, accurate, because if you're like watchmojo.com and you produce a list of top 10 somethings and then a fan of those somethings comes along, you can bet your bottom dollar they'll have a few things to say about why you're an idiot, why the people who work at Watch Mojo are idiots, and why that is not the difference. It's like, yeah, yes, they're doing that deliberately. You know that. They're getting things wrong to in order to rile you up so you feel you absolutely must put them right. So maybe we should do things. Of course, Bruce Campbell is well known for his giant collection of koi carp, and also for appearing in a series of television commercials for the perennial Mr. Pibb soft drink. Okay, now I've thrown out two complete blatant lies about Bruce Campbell. So now we need you as Bruce Campbell fans to come to our Facebook page and put me right, because I'm wrong, or something. Because, you know, you try and engage these people in conversation, and they're just not interested. Which we should probably mention that there'll be an accompanying article to this episode when it goes out, appearing on Pop Culture blog Trash Mutant, available at trashmutant.com and also, predictably enough, on Facebook. So why not be fans of Revenge of the 80s Kids and Trash Mutant? We are like a sort of half and half hideous shambling monster composed partly of podcast and partly of a sort of written fanzine type content, because I am the bridge. I am the very cord that binds together these two atrocious offences against...
I enjoy our mutant zombie wing, because it's less work for me.
It is far less work for you, because you don't have to do anything. I just write the articles and go along to that. So, yes, so that that kind of covers it. We're the 80s kids. We're available at, what's our blog spot address again, Ian? You may as well do one of them.
Oh, for the old time's sake, I'm a bit out of practice, you know. You should give me warning of these things, because I haven't got my links ready. It's the80skids, and that's all letters, .blogspot.com.
Yeah, so that's where you can find our main home. That is where all the shows are. It's all, that's all where all the stuff is. We're obviously available on all the major podcast aggregators, so iTunes and stuff like that. To be fair, I only know that we're on iTunes by rumour because I don't have an Apple product. So I, as such, I am excluded from
my iTunes. My sister was trying the week trying to find my podcast and she was typing this in and couldn't find it. So I had to direct her towards our Blogspot page.
And it's really weird because, you probably get an Apple link straight off the Anchor page, which is our sort of across the board place that shows come out. Those are only some of the newer shows. So that's it. So we essentially, the blog spot is where we can definitely find us there, and you can definitely find us on Facebook, Revenge of the 80s Kids, all very easy, great to find us on Facebook. And in fact, the Facebook links to the blog, so it all joins up quite nicely. But then there is also the Trash Mutant component. I think, to a certain extent, Bruce Campbell is uncontroversial, although I'm sure that many people out there think that he's rubbish. So if you want to tell us about that, that's fine. But I am also going to say, it might be nice. Make him a scrapbook. He's worked terribly hard all these years. And I think that possibly it might be nicer to send him something a little bit weightier than our endorsement of his gurning, plate smashing, overacting kind of thing. Oh, you're so funny, Mr. Campbell. Just to say, hey, dude, we realise what you've done, you know, for the cause of fandom. I think that's the main thing. He is right there entrenched. He's not a fan, but he's in the fandom. And that's why he deserves a little bit extra, I think. So that is my final thought on Bruce Campbell. Have I brought you round? You instantly... You're going to go to Amazon Global Store and buy Adventures of Briscoe County and Jack of All Trades to watch on DVD, Ian? Or are you just slightly like him a bit better, feel you might go to his Twitter and hurl insults at him, maybe?
Acquiring those properties is but one of the possible futures that lies ahead of me. And you know what? He's a guy I always knew and have no objection to him. He's not in, you know, that much. When he does come on, I suppose it's a special treat. It's a shame I can't get stars. Well, I suppose I could get stars, not subscribe to the particularly right thing to go watch it. But, you know, I can always request a DVD for Christmas. Get me the Evil Dead's Ash vs. Evil Dead for Christmas, please.
But if you're obviously a fan of the 80s kids, then it's a lot easier to get hold of us. We'll probably be back next week. In fact, if you're listening to this fresh... As it were, we definitely will be back next week. But for now, I think we've said all that is groovy. And so we're going off to have some tea and ask our wives to give us some sugar, baby. That's me. Bye bye.
First you try to kill me, then you try to kiss me.